The Guardian.
It's grey, it's miserable, it's raining. Welcome to Glasgow.
I'm optimistic about the digital future, that's for sure, but whether the digital future is DAB is another question.
In radio, the measures that have been taken in response to the scandal have been just as harsh and just as draconian as those in television.
The old business model for commercial radio in this country, I think it is broken. But I think the people who are working in it know that too.
This is Media Talk, this is Jeremy Vine, and this is such a privilege.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Media Talk, live-ish from Scotland's second city. Coming up, we hear from some of the stars and suits of the wireless world as we discuss the big issues of this year's Radio Academy Festival. Is DAB the future? Will the analogue signal ever be switched off? Is the UK radio industry on the verge of a nervous breakdown? And just where can producer Ben get a cup of peppermint tea in Glasgow? These stories and more coming up in this special edition of Media Talk from The Guardian. Yes, forget about Glastonbury, the big chill and latitude. There's only one festival worth the journey this year, the Radio Festival 2008, here in sometimes sunny Glasgow. It's been a veritable who's who of BBC and commercial radio bigwigs. Well, apart from the entire global radio group, who are much too busy taking over things to be here. Anyway, first up on the festival lineup was the big issue hanging over the radio industry. To misquote Bill Clinton, it's the platform, stupid.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on Guardian.co.uk.
Well, I've just come out of a session about the future of digital radio, a roadmap to an all-digital future presented by the Digital Radio Working Group, which, quite honestly, had the audience collectively slitting its wrists, apart from being a desperately, desperately dull presentation. I mean, incomprehensible in parts. What I took from it was that digital radio faces massive, massive problems ahead, huge obstacles. According to the working group, only 28% of homes have DAB. There are massive gaps in coverage around the country, huge areas that have no coverage at all. There's no common European standard, and it'll take 6 years, at least 6 years, to get into cars where 20% of radio listening takes place. And absolutely the key thing, I think, is that there's no government support for a switchover date.
Barry Cox, and I'm chair of the Digital Radio Working Group. We recommend that the government adopts a path to digital migration. We think there should be a set of criteria, like half of the listening hours are to DAB is an important one. When we get to that point, which we would argue probably is between 2012, 2015, then they should start migrating all national and regional stations and large local stations onto DAB and off of FM.
What I found very striking from the presentation that you gave this morning was that there was a whole list of obstacles and problems and difficulties in your way. And it seems that you've discovered a whole load of problems and it's yet to be identified about how you're going to surmount those. And is it doable?
Some of the problems we think are achievable. I mean, the whole issue of cars and the failure of digital radio to go into cars, we think that is solvable, both by creation of a European standard for digital. Countries have got different variants on that, but they can be homogenised and made. Radios can receive them all quite easily. And also answering the coverage issues in the UK, because there are still serious gaps in digital coverage. Those two would effectively solve the car radio problem. It would take 5-6 years for us to see that, but that's fine. You know, as long as we get on with it, that's okay. That's one of the issues. The other one is that the industry needs to coordinate its messages better. But they know that, and I think that will happen, not because we suggested it, but because they themselves will come to that. I don't have any doubt that digital radio will grow. In about 5 years' time, we could start a switch-off. It doesn't mean FM will disappear completely. We recognise that for community radio stations and for some parts of the UK where the prospect of having digital radio, it's not clear when it will be affordable to build the transmitters, not let alone receive it. So there'll be a three-stage process, in effect. With luck, most of us will have digital-only radio by 2020. And at some point thereafter, in the rest of the country gets it, we will have kind of DAB plus fill-in. So it's three stages.
You're talking about a 12-year process. Mm. Isn't it the case that technology is moving in a 12-month cycle? In 12 years' time, DAB could be left way behind.
Well, there is, of course, that possibility. But in a sense, the television is having to live with this. We designed digital terrestrial television on a standard which is called MPEG-2. There's a new standard now called MPEG-4. We've got to start going over that process again. The truth is we are now in a computer world and where the platforms move on and change fairly regularly. We've all got to get used to that in broadcast, and we will have to change and adapt and live with legacy issues. All this will have to happen. So it's not unique to DAB. You know, the fact that DAB will be overtaken at some point in the next 20 or 30 years, yes, of course it will. I'm afraid we are past the period where you buy a receiver and you sit and you listen to it or watch it for 30, 40 years. That's gone.
So that was Barry Cox, chair of the very sexily titled DRWG. But what do the audience make of his plan?
Nicholas Wheeler, managing director of ITN on mobile, on broadband, on radio. I've always been optimistic about radio and the future of radio, providing it gets its act together to work as a sort of 360 medium. I think if we stand in isolation, we're going to be in a bit of difficulty. And I felt what was slightly disturbing about the session on digital this morning was, here we are, all this time after digital launch, still discussing whether DAB is the right way forward or not. And surely we've got to put that to bed. We've got to get behind this, make it work, and get on to the next thing, or we're going to be discussing this in another 10 years' time. And God help us then.
I'm James Crittenden. I'm head of Future Media and Technology for BBC Audio Music Interactive. I thought there was a lot of very intelligent things said. I should point out that I am on one of those groups, making sure that we work with Europe and make sure that we have a Europe-wide plan makes an awful lot of sense. Basically, you know, that to me is where we should be headed in the future.
I'm Jez Nelson, creative director of an independent production company called Something Else. It does seem to be a bit of an omission that there's no part of that committee which is looking at content. I appreciate totally that is the job of the broadcasters, but it would seem to be one of the fundamental factors in whether there's going to be an uptake in digital radio, so I would have thought that they would consider it in some sense.
At ITN, I run a mobile and a broadband production unit of some 40 people, and if I can look ahead 12 months, I'm doing well. So looking ahead 12 years is an impossible task in this fast-moving world.
I'm optimistic about the digital future, that's for sure, but whether the digital future is DAB is another question, and I think, you know, the jury's out.
Well, I don't know about you lot, but that was all a bit depressing. So who better to lift our spirits and give us that warm, fuzzy glow than the festival's charming and elegant host, Jeremy Vine? He told me what made him fall in love with radio in the first place.
When I was 12, I wrote to Capital Radio, to Kenny Everett's show on Sundays, actually, and said, can I be your young DJ? Because he had a little slot for somebody young to do, like, four or five records. And it was put together by a woman called Maggie Norden. It was called Hullabaloo. And bang, one Sunday, I'm in the middle of Kenny Everett's show. Sadly, my bit was pre-recorded, so I didn't meet him. But I just remember going into Capital up that big staircase and thinking...
Yeah, what was it like going in and walking into the room where Kenny Everett produces his show from?
You know, for me, because in our sort of 1960s childhoods, Matt, you'll appreciate this, we had this sort of analogue childhood where we just had a small television set in the corner doing very interesting things and nothing else. It was like a total revelation. Oh, my goodness, there is something at the other end of radio. So I go up the staircase, I go into the studios, and there's Roger Scott in this glass cubicle, and somebody said, don't walk around the front of him because he doesn't like it. And I remember looking at him thinking, I really want to do that. So the people always say you're bitten by the bug, and I actually was. It really was a massive moment.
Now, at the other end of your career, fast forwarding back to today, well, 5 years ago actually, when you were phoned up or approached and asked to take on that venerable institution, Radio 2, 12 till 2 lunchtimes from a great broadcaster. How long did it take you to say yes?
It took me longer than it should have done. I needed a bit of persuading from a couple of people who were, you know, on it. Because one friend of mine particularly said, this is prime BBC real estate, the Radio 2 show, the Jimmy Young show, you have to take it. But my problem understanding that was that basically as a news person, I mean, you Matt, understand this completely, you know, my job was to get a notepad and go out the building with a pen and find something out and write it down and come back. And that's what news is. That's the dynamic of news. Radio 2 was a world I had never been into before. I didn't even know what the building looked like. I didn't know where they broadcast from. But Newsnight to Radio 2, for me, just, I'm so pleased I did it. It's the best thing. And the funny thing about it is, after the Capital Radio experience when I was 12, I come back and I say to my mum, I want to play records for a living. And she says, okay, that's fine. We'll support you. But you need to understand that maybe that probably it's not the thing you're going to do for to make money for the rest of your life. You have to maybe find something else. So 38 years old or whatever it was, I start on Radio 2, Thunder Road, Bruce Springsteen. I say, Mum, you were wrong.
Watch out, Sir Terence. Now, until her Prescott-esque punch at Glastonbury last weekend, Amy Winehouse had managed to stay out of the papers for, oh, at least 3 minutes. Dear old Amy is almost as ubiquitous a fixture on TV and radio news bulletins as she is in the tabloids, and in The Guardian too, it must be said. But why are journalists focusing their energies on such piffle, or for our Scottish listeners, pish? I spoke to Vanessa Feltz and the editor of Radio 1 Newsbeat, Rod McKenzie, to find out more.
Well, I straddle the issue because I have been featured on the news. I've been tortured by the news. I've done things I regret which have been proclaimed on the news. And yet, of course, I'm a journalist and I broadcast every day on the BBC and I write columns in newspapers. I've been a newspaper columnist for about 25 years. So I shamelessly deal in celebrity doings and wrongdoings.
But it seems to me that you are concerned about it, that you're worried about the whole news agenda and the way it's going.
Well, I'm concerned about unkindness, intrusiveness, and also a kind of gratuitous interest in trivia, personal trivia. I mean, I talked just now about a BBC news bulletin which dealt with Lily Allen's miscarriage, and I really felt she's 23 years old, she's lost a baby, there's no baby to talk of, there's no potential to this story, it's actually a complete no-happener, and it should be a private matter between her and a gynaecologist. I didn't feel comfortable broadcasting on a BBC that put that out as a main mid-morning news story.
What sort of judgments do you make at Radio 1, Rod, about the sorts of stories, entertainment stories, that you might run and might not run?
Well, I think we have to, number one, put the audience first. We know that the audience wants to hear entertainment news, but we're also the BBC, and we have an editorial standard, and the editorial standard must be that the story is checked out, is verified, and is run responsibly. A lot of this stuff is about tone and running orders. So in other words, it's not a hysterical let's get the celeb tone, but it needs to be factual. Often it will be the celebrity putting their side of the story against an allegation that's been made maybe in the printed media.
Isn't that just an excuse to run stories that you wouldn't otherwise have run, to say, oh, the tabloid, let's look at what the tabloids are saying about a story, or there's been a denial, so now we can run the story. Isn't that just an excuse?
No, I don't think it is an excuse. If there is a denial, that is what makes it a story. For example, we have not covered the Madonna-Guy Ritchie supposed marriage breakup at all. We haven't mentioned a word of it up to now.
But just because there's a statement, a denial, the story's not changed. It's still in the same state, isn't it, as it was before?
I don't believe journalistically. I think once a statement is made, we should report it, whether it's Gordon Brown making a statement or the chief of the defence staff making a statement or Madonna and Guy Ritchie. Well, I think that's reportable.
Vanessa, what do you make of that distinction? There's been a statement made now in the Madonna story, so you can report it.
Well, it gives it some kind of legitimacy. I suppose the question is not whether you could report it, but whether you should report it. Not whether people will be interested, but whether it's in their interest to have that information. Obviously, there's an insatiable appetite for trivia, showbiz invasion of all kinds. People would like to, if they could, have a good look at Cheryl Cole's toenail clippings. It doesn't mean that they should be available on the BBC website for all to behold. Just because people thoroughly enjoy it, just because it sells seats and sells copies, doesn't necessarily mean that they should be subsumed in an absolute eddying, turbulent river of gossip, tittle-tattle, nasty allegation, etc. I mean, it's not going to be long, I imagine, till celebrity x-rays are available on the net and, you know, the results of women's cervical smears. It's only going to be a matter of time.
I'm Matt Wells. You're listening to Media Talk from The Guardian, almost live and on location from the Radio Academy Festival in Glasgow. Still to come.
For as long as I can remember, and that's quite a long way back now, it was standard practice to choose people to go on the air in competitions because they sounded really good and they were going to contribute to the radio programme.
Former Radio 1 controller Matthew Bannister tells us why the regulatory backlash over phone-in fakery is killing creativity in radio. Plus, we get a tour around the award-winning glass shoebox. That's the new home for BBC Scotland. I should say, by the way, hello to the people who've come up and said hello to producer Ben and I at the radio festival here. It's very nice to be so closely connected with the audience, it says here. Anyway, those stories coming up. But first, let's hand back to our London studio and get up to speed on the other media stories making the headlines over the past 7 days. Matt, over to you. Thank you, Matt. Splendid work so far. Now I'm joined in the studio by Media Guardian columnist Steve Hewlett, resplendent in his Wimbledon whites. Hello, Steve. How are
Hello.
You?
If you think you need a Wimbledon whites, I think you need a new optician.
We'll come on to some TV stories in a moment, but let's just stick with radio for just a sec. Now, last week's announcement of Tim Davey as the successor to Jenny Abramsky at the top of BBC Radio caused a bit of a stir. If you remember, our very own Emily Bell wrote a piece in Media Guardian a couple of weeks ago suggesting that the BBC should appoint anyone but him. Humble pie, Miss Bell?
I set his appointment with Signal. It would be an extraordinary signal to the BBC radio department and indeed the outside world. There are several ways of reading the words extraordinary. I think it's an extraordinarily good appointment.
Well, Tim Davey was in Glasgow for the start of the radio festival. He's a bit of a Jose Mourinho lookalike, Steve.
Well, funnily enough, with her skill with words and meaning is so profound. I think possibly Emily should be applying for his old job. I think for radio, it's I don't quite know what it means for radio, except that, of course, all the incumbents, the people running the channels. But one of the things, we've discussed this before, yeah. But the BBC's radio business has been very well run, not least because the people running each of the bits really appear to know what they're doing. You know, Damaser and Leslie Douglas and
Andy Parfitt,
yeah. You know, at the chap at Radio 3. So they would feel reasonably secure with this, I suspect, because he's unlikely to be leaning over their shoulders saying, press this button, press that button.
Yes, part perhaps from Andy Parfitt, who applied for the job, of course.
Yes, no doubt he'll feel slight. He may even feel slighted if not put out. But in terms of the day-to-day job, right. You know, is there a better job for him than the one he's got, other than the one he wanted but hasn't got? Probably not. I don't think Tim Davey's the kind of person. I don't think he's the sort of person who's going to try and lean over Andy Parfitt's shoulder and say, "Tell him which slider to." Yes. Twiddle with.
Fader, I think.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah.
Okay. Well, if it's not bad news for radio, then what does it mean for marketing?
Well, I think that's is the sort of bigger question, because, you know, Tim Davey was running an empire called, you know, MCA, Marketing, Communications and Audiences, and it's been very much M, you know, with quite a bit of A, and not quite so successful on the C front.
Right.
Well, you might say, looking forward...
Sounds vaguely rude, doesn't it?
Da, 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 yeah.
Oh, YMC. Yeah, so okay,
you might say, looking forward, we're looking now... There's this argument about an excess licence fee that won't go away.
Yeah.
There's now already discussion of the next licence fee settlement, i.e. post-2012. So we're looking at a new settlement in 5 years' time. These things take a very long time to happen. If the BBC's been... If the BBC has come unstuck anywhere, it's arguably, in terms of its positioning, think... 18 million for Jonathan Ross.
Yes.
Yeah, could be justified in detail, but, you know, where's it got them? Well, it probably lost them £1.5 billion of licence fee revenue. Gordon Brown thinks they're so got so much money they don't know what to do with it. It hasn't gone well. So in terms of positioning, either corporate communications function, I think where they're going to, probably, where it'll be now more C, quite a lot less M, and with a smattering of A.
We want more C from the MCA department of the BBC, is what you're saying.
That's it.
Right, OK.
But don't forget the A.
OK.
Never forget you have to have a smattering of A.
OK. Basically, it's a communications job that needs to be done, heading for the next licence fee settlement.
Yes, which, the aftermath of the Ofcom PSB review, wherever that leaves the BBC, defence of the licence fee, funding of Channel 4, all those issues. The next time round, this time round, no one has called into question the BBC's existence.
No.
Everyone has kind of coalesced around a position which says, we've got the BBC, we all agree about that. Then the question is, what else do we need?
Well, they're going to have to deal with, whoever it is going to have to deal with the likes of, you know, Channel 4 now saying, what were they saying this week, that they're going to do regional news?
Well, I hesitate to say this, but, you know, one almost despairs. I mean, is there anything Channel 4 won't say they'll do for money? I mean,
well, for public money, anyway. Yes.
Well, you do wonder, don't you? I mean, it just smacks of opportunism. I mean,
well, they haven't even managed to launch their radio stations yet.
Tell you what, if take ITV's figures or take half of ITV's figures, and what they say it costs them. If you think radio's expensive, try regional news.
Good luck.
So it's all very well to say they'll do these things, but first of all, they've got no track record of it. How many regional offices has Channel 4 got to build this network around?
Well, they haven't got any way.
Is the future of local news?
They've got Stuart Cosgrove in Glasgow, and that's about it, isn't it?
Yeah, but he's in someone else's office.
Is he?
And I think spent most of his time on the plane. But look, but the other thing is the future of local news? Surely the future of local news is about what comes from areas, localities, means things to people in localities, whether that's the nations of the UK or Manchester or even more local than that. It can't be someone in Horseferry Road deciding what they should listen to in Hull.
Well, that's Tim Davey. The interesting thing about Tim Davey at the radio festival was he was there, but he wasn't actually speaking publicly because he doesn't take up his appointment in until September. So he was there, but he wasn't there. Very odd situation. Anyway, let's move on to the rest of the week's stories. ITV, you mentioned ITV, but the share price tanking.
I think the professional term is in the shit. So dare I say. No, look, it hasn't half tanked. I think as we speak, it's about 38 pence.
Have you sold your shares in ITV?
Some time ago, fortunately, yes. No, I didn't invest in Northern Rock.
I was going to say, traded them in for Northern Rock, which is a more attractive prospect, yes. Why is this happening?
Well, I think there's a variety of things. You have to remember, what investors put money into companies because of the expectation of growth. So it doesn't mean that ITV is an unprofitable company. Actually, as its last results showed, it is far from unprofitable. It has its strategic issues and over time may well become less profitable. The thing that's triggering this, though, I think, is a combination of factors. Actually, ITV's on-air performance and its revenue performance and its share of commercial impacts, it's beating the market in the first half of 2008. This is ITV's best performance on those measures for some years. However, in the context of the prospect of there being a recession, remember, ITV is a business where the fixed costs are high and you can't change them very quickly. Mm. So when you've ordered the drama 18 months ago, it's going to cost you £1 million an hour. You can't suddenly cut the cost. You've actually spent the money. So ITV's cost base is quite high and it's quite fixed. So looking at the second half of 2008, actually, if things remain as they are, ITV will do OK in 2008. But there's just the possibility that if the brakes really go on the economy, if recession really bites, advertising starts disappearing off the network, ITV's got nowhere else to go. Its revenues go down, its costs stay the same. In terms of profitability, it gets squeezed very, very quickly.
But Marks & Spencer's just issued a big profits warning this week. All those lovely M&S ads, they're going to get
Okay, well, you've got retail, you've got housing market, you've got Taylor Woodrow, cutting back like mad. Financial services, well, there begins with F, but they're in it. and so, where is the buoyancy in the free-to-air advertising market? Interestingly, I wasn't alone, naturally, there were several hundreds of people there. I was at Sky's summer reception just last night.
Oh, yes.
Where the atmosphere was, well, they weren't lauding it, but they were quietly confident, and actually one can sort of see why, because their subscription base means that although their advertising too, is in the what's it, actually their subscription base is pretty strong, and they've got a pretty resilient revenue stream. And you can't help but think, if there's a long-term future for funding media businesses, the idea that it all has to depend on advertising when it is so flaky.
All right.
Got there yet.
Do we care about Jordan and Peter Andre? What, producer Ben, what does Jordan and Peter Andre do?
News of the World, isn't it?
They won a case against News of the World. And do you care, Steve, about the fact that Heinz has had their gay kiss ad cleared by Ofcom, which I suppose confirms only the fact that it was not a very good ad and not offensive?
Not offensive enough, probably, yes.
Not offensive enough. Okay.
I don't care, really, no.
Well, I think that's our lot. Thank you very much, Steve Hewlett. Time now to rejoin our regional news team in Glasgow.
Media Talk from Guardian.co.uk.
I'm standing on the banks of the River Clyde outside the new headquarters of BBC Scotland, built on the site of a former Clyde shipyard. They've been in the building about a year now, and not all of it's working. Some of the technology is still to be ironed out. But it's been shortlisted for the Stirling Prize for Architecture, which is the top architecture prize in the UK. But quite frankly, I really don't see what all the fuss is about. It's just a big glass box, certainly from the outside anyway.
My name is Maggie Cunningham. I'm Joint Head of Programmes and Services at BBC Scotland. We're in the foyer of Pacific Quay, which is the BBC's headquarters in Glasgow. It is a big open space. It's deliberately built this way so that it's an attractive space for people who actually are passing by, who can wander in and go into our little pods over there. We've got little pods where they can watch some output, play with the computers, and generally have a history of media.
Hello and welcome to Beechgrove Garden in what I can best describe as a sunny interlude, because heaven knows what it'll be like in an hour's time.
We've got a radio studio, a drama and music studio, and then a small television studio, and then the big television studio, which is as big as any television studios in the UK. So the whole building is deliberately built to hide, effectively, almost hide the studios, but then to use this fantastic terraced space.
Now, this is a new building. It's a year old, cost £188 million, and on the outside resembles largely a big glass box, but it's much more impressive inside. And what strikes you about it is the colour. It's a Glasgow colour, isn't it? This is the red sandstone of the city.
Absolutely red sandstone of the city. And also it has a wee bit of feel of the shipyards as well. If you look at the grey, you know, it feels very much part of its place sitting next door to the Clyde. I love it. I love walking in here. And I always walk up the stairs. I never use the lift.
Well, it's absolutely stunning, because when you look at it, it's almost like a bicolour, two yellows there.
Yeah. And that one's my name's Andrea Miller. I'm the head of factual department at BBC Scotland. We are on the south side of the building, and that side is the factual department. I'll just show you where we are. We have a red shed in front of us, which was put there as a joke by the designers,
okay.
Which we've never really found all that funny.
Can you meet? Is there room to meet inside the red shed? No, it's quite a small little room.
At one point, it had the culture show's foosball table in it,
right?
Which, as you can see, has now been moved to another more useful location. And then we have our own gnome. This is the science area here. This is where they're making Jimmy's Farm Heroes with Jimmy Docherty.
And what difference has it made to you as a programme maker working in this building compared to your old place at Queen Margaret Drive?
Mostly we have what we call the PQ effect, which is if you're sitting in the main atrium, which is this sort of ziggurat which houses the studios, if you're having a conversation about something, some problem you want to solve, 90% of the time the person you want to solve it will walk past you. And that's one of the huge benefits about the connectedness of the building, the way the sort of public space works.
So this is your biggest studio, Studio A. And what size of studio is this then?
Oh, I'm hopeless on statistics, but it is as big. It is comparable to any other big entertainment studio in the UK. So TBC One is as big as that.
Tonight in Newsnight Scotland, a second party leader within a week resigns.
A news hub round here where all the intake comes in and then gets moved to television, radio, online. The content gets manipulated here
to whichever platform
it should work, it goes to.
And what's the advantage?
The change, when it all works as effectively as it should, is that anybody can access it for whatever medium they're working on, and they can change it, develop it, move it for specific purposes very quickly.
Scotland's weather, showers will start to break out during the course of the morning.
I don't think anybody would say that it hasn't been worth it. I think it's given us a real sense of energy and ambition. The important thing for us in BBC Scotland is to make sure that we understand what the audience need is, and that audience need evolves in a devolved country as devolution evolves. So I think we have to be very careful to remember we're the BBC and to continue to deliver what we believe is the best content that we can deliver to audiences. And while the political battles rage, I think it's just important for us to continue to develop a real sense of energy around driving content for audiences, because at the end of the day, it's just about that and nothing else.
Comply or Die, that was the title of the talk by former BBC Radio 1 boss Matthew Bannister. In his presentation, he spoke to a number of broadcasters sacked for misdemeanours ranging from John Holmes getting a young caller to say soapy titwank live on Virgin Radio to X. I wonder if that will get me into trouble for saying that live on Guardian Radio. Anyway, we'll see. To X, TalkSport shock jock James Whale allegedly calling on listeners to support Boris Johnson in the recent London mayoral election. Suffice to say, Ofcom was not amused. Throw in a record-breaking fine for GCAP, producers being sacked for phone-in fraud, and the general feeling of mistrust in the media, and conditions are ripe for a collective nervous breakdown in the radio industry. Matthew Bannister came into our studio to tell us about his findings.
I've just been reading Ron Neal's report, which was commissioned by the BBC Trust, to look into how well they'd done in the last year in responding to these issues. And it runs to 61 pages plus appendices. And it's a sort of mountain of industry that's been going on in the BBC. There have been at least three central forums set up on the subject of editorial standards with very senior people involved. There have been a number of forms invented. So you now have to fill out one of a number of forms if you want to put a competition on the air on BBC Radio. And 14,700 staff have been sent through this workshop called Safeguarding Trust. I escaped from it because there was a sort of get-out clause which,
for freelancers,
if you were a presenter, you got 20 minutes with the head of department.
Oh, right.
So I had 20 minutes with the head of department. But those who've been on the course tell me it's a pretty constructive thing. It's not about people laying down the law in a draconian way. It is about people sharing case studies. But what I think is the cumulative effect of all of this, in many cases, a kind of sledgehammer to crack a nut, that it's a huge response to issues which were confined to a few areas, and which is now affecting every member of staff and every programme maker.
Right. Well, you say it's a sledgehammer to crack a nut, but surely, you agree that competitions, voting, and any other kind of form of public interaction has to be conducted in a kind of fair and transparent way, and that what the BBC is doing is just ensuring that.
Well, it has to be conducted in a fair and transparent way, and we don't know how many more examples there are of it not being conducted in a fair and transparent way. But certain issues arise about this, because in radio, for as long as I can remember, and that's quite a long way back now, it was standard practice to choose people to go on the air in competitions because they sounded really good and they were going to contribute to the radio programme. Or it was standard practice, if you were in local radio, to choose people from different parts of the county that you were serving in order to show that you had a proper spread of listening. So if you were in Cambridge, you always wanted somebody from the Peterborough area. And in commercial radio with their big prize giveaways, you always wanted what they called a screamer, i.e. somebody who was going to respond enthusiastically and well when they won the £10,000 prize.
But yes,
not somebody who says yes. Yeah. So now this is about making good radio programmes. Now, if you select those people,
and you think that all of this stamps on that, and that's a bad thing.
Yes, I think all of this certainly stops all of that. You have to deal with people fairly and openly, and you have to make sure that the rules of the competition are clear and transparent. But you also have to make good radio programmes, and I think colleagues are struggling now with what they are and are not allowed to do. And this form filling, I mean, the form filling to put a competition on the air includes a section which says, has the person who's approved this been through the following training courses? And then lists three training courses which you have to tick in order to prove that the person who's been on it has been on the appropriate training courses. And I sometimes just wonder how experienced programme makers react, because these are people who've been in the business, executive producers who've been in the business for a long time. How do they react when confronted with a form that they have to tick that says, I've been on X course, I've been on Y course, I've been on Z course? They've been taking difficult editorial decisions for many years.
So are there ways, do you think, Matthew, of reconciling the desire to be more open and transparent with the public with making good radio programmes?
Yes, of course. The interesting theme, I think, in public life at the moment, not just in broadcasting, is about the tension between the attempt to control things centrally and set targets for them centrally, and the devolution of power to the grassroots. I think it's a big theme in teaching. I think it's a big theme in many public services, the police and others, where people are groaning and saying, we're under this huge burden of centrally driven targets, paperwork, bureaucracy, and we can't just do the job that we're here to do. And I fear that broadcasting professionals are suffering the same fate. What I think we should have is not just safeguarding trust with the listener, we should have trust in experienced programme makers. And if we can't trust them, we're appointing the wrong people.
Is this a story that's just about the BBC, or do you think there's a backwash into commercial radio as well?
Well, I talked to Christian O'Connell about this on Virgin Radio, and he said, absolutely, since the row about competitions, all their procedures have been tightened up, all the meetings he now has to go to before he can do anything on the air, all the paperwork that his producer, poor producer now, has to fill out has definitely increased. And I hear similar stories from other parts of commercial radio.
Especially, I guess, with the increasing consolidation and bigger organisations.
Well, they're going to have their own bureaucracy, aren't they? Of course, any group which gets larger needs to impose a bureaucracy in order to have central control. I think there should be more devolution and more trust. I think it's absolutely right that if someone does something wrong, they should be fired. Of course that's right. If they break the rules in a big way, if they do something that's wrong, they should lose their job. But this kind of endless pettifogging bureaucracy and form-filling seems to suggest that the centre has lost the trust in the programme makers.
Matthew Bannister there, and you can read more about that story and all the other stories making the news from the radio festival at mediaguardian.co.uk/radio. So, this has been a bumper edition of the podcast, and as I'm again given the signal to wrap up, what have we learned? Well, more people are listening to radio than ever before. The truth behind GCAP's record fine is far, far juicier than anyone realised. Media Monkey is onto you, and we know who you are. And actually, Tim Davey may be just what BBC Radio needs. Who'd have thought? Anyway, who better to conclude proceedings than Trevor Dann, director of the Radio Academy?
The phrase you keep hearing now is the phrase business model. You hear it from the record business, the music business. You hear it obviously in radio. You hear it in everywhere where the Guardian swims too. And business models are changing. The old business model for commercial radio in this country
is it broken?
I think it is broken. But I think the people who are working in it know that too. And when I say it's broken, it doesn't mean it stopped delivering any cash, because it will carry on delivering some cash for a long time to come. But what I think everybody realises now is that operating in the new media space isn't just a nice to have. It's not like an add-on to your business. It increasingly is your business.
And what about the BBC? They've got a new director of audio and music who has been here but not here. Strange, isn't it? He's said nothing, but he's lurked.
Well, I don't blame Tim Davey for not saying anything, because he's got to read himself into the job, hasn't he? And he hasn't started it yet, and he won't start it until after the summer. He's a good guy. When you meet him, the thing that comes out, it's not just that he knows marketing backwards, but that he actually loves radio. He's really, really keen on
people
radio.
People always say this, but do you get the sense that's right?
I really felt that with him. Obviously, you know, you're a bit suspicious, aren't you? It's an easy knock for the BBC, isn't it, to say, well, marketing, that's the last thing they need. They've got nearly 60% of the audience. What do they need marketing for? Well, I think there are some marketing issues, but I think also he's probably a pretty good team captain. People who've worked for him say that that's his style, that he is a good leader. And I think there are some issues for the BBC around making their digital offer competitive with their analogue offer. Because at the moment they're great little stations, but they're run as subsidiaries to the main business of the BBC. And if we're going to go digital in 10 years, 20 years, however long, they've got to be resourced and marketed just as much as the big networks.
Trevor Dann, big fan of the show. He asked us three times to be on. Hell of a festival, Trev. Well, that's it from our misadventures outside the London media bubble. Normal service will resume inside the M25 next week. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green, who did actually find his peppermint tea in the end. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.